From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, as part of our weekly archive edition of the show, we feature an interview with Buddy Guy, the blues musician Eric Clapton called the best guitarist alive. Also, jazz singer Annie Ross, formerly of Lambert Hendricks and Ross. She wrote the lyric for Twisted, a song which was later recorded by Joni Mitchell and Bette Midler. You can see Ross now in the new film Shortcuts. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews tonight's season premiere of the Emmy Award-winning show Picket Fences. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali made a quick visit to the UN peacekeeping mission in Mogadishu today, despite President Clinton's recommendation that he not go. Boutros-Ghali is widely disliked by some Somali factions for UN efforts to disarm clan militiamen. His visit sparked protests in the capital. NPR's Michael Scholar reports.
Crowds gathered in parts of Mogadishu controlled by Mohamed Farah Aidid's subclan. They yelled, "Down with Boutros-Ghali and Stinking Ghali," and said they would cut him in pieces if he came to Mogadishu. The largest group of about 500 or more gathered in a large plaza where Aidid rallies occur twice a week. One man grabbed me to explain why Boutros-Ghali is so hated. The man said when Boutros-Ghali was foreign minister of Egypt, he had supported the former Somali dictator Mohamed Siad Barre. And now, the man said, the UN Secretary General is trying to kill Somali children and women with bullets. Two others got in a shouting match over the U.S. One said the U.S. was behind the violence, though most agreed the U.S. is on their side now that it has changed its policy and has stopped pursuing Aidid. This is Michael Scholar in Mogadishu.
Secretary of State Warren Christopher said today that President Clinton will travel to Moscow sometime in January to meet with Russian President Boris Yeltsin. An exact date for the summit meeting hasn't been set. In an effort to find votes for the North American Free Trade Agreement, President Clinton has signaled that he's ready to abandon a plan to raise taxes to pay for the cost of the agreement. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President Clinton is utterly dependent on Republican support to pass the NAFTA. He finds the treaty a hard sell among members of his own party. But if the treaty goes into effect and tariffs with Mexico are eliminated, the U.S. Treasury will lose hundreds of millions of dollars. According to the budget rules, that money has to be replaced with either more taxes or with spending cuts. The administration first proposed doubling the $5 a head airline and cruise ship tax. Then it scaled back the increase to $2.50. But Republican lawmakers are ruling out any taxes. The president suggested he didn't care where the money came from. All I want to do is comply with the budget requirements, Clinton said. And U.S. Trade Representative Mickey Cantor said the administration is now searching for other ways to make up for the lost revenue. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street, even after falling back from a big advance earlier in the day. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 13 points to close at 3,649. Declines led advances by a slight margin in heavy trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 301 million shares. The NASDAQ gained 1.4 to close at 772.7. This is NPR. In Florida, four teenagers have been indicted on murder and attempted murder charges in the shooting of a British tourist at a highway rest stop. The four boys charged in the shooting range from 13 to 16. They're accused in the murder of Gary Colley and the wounding of his girlfriend, Margaret Jagger, during an attempted robbery in September. A Florida state attorney said prosecutors may seek the death penalty against all four. Clashes broke out today between thousands of striking Air France workers and riot police at one airport in Paris. Another group blocked highways leading to the city's other commercial airport. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
The clashes broke out at the airport at Orly, south of Paris, where several thousand striking Air France employees threw rocks at riot police. The police responded by lobbing tear gas bombs at the crowd. Police have been guarding the airport for several days to prevent protesters from storming onto the runways. Riot police are also being deployed at the Charles de Gaulle Airport north of the city, where hundreds of striking Air France workers prevented passengers from entering the airport by blocking the main highway. The workers are protesting a plan by Air France to cut wages and 4,000 jobs by the end of next year. The Minister of Transport says the plan will be maintained, but in hopes of ending the five-day strike, he's agreed to talk to the demonstrators. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
Bank America Corporation said today that it plans to eliminate as many as 3,700 jobs by the end of next year. The nation's second-largest banking company said the cuts are needed to keep expenses in line with its diminished revenues. The job cuts would amount to about 3.8% of the bank's workforce around the world. Bank Chairman Richard Rosenberg said the cost-cutting measures will reduce the bank's expenses by about $250 million. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Rock guitar heroes like Eric Clapton, Jeff Beck, and the late Stevie Ray Vaughan have called Buddy Guy their favorite guitarist. Buddy Guy was one of the first blues guitarists to use electronic feedback and distortion. Guy was born in rural Louisiana in 1936, the son of sharecroppers. He set out for Chicago as a young man and quickly became a central part of that city's blues scene. He has his own club there now called Legends. Recently, a box set of his sessions for the Chess record label from the 1960s was reissued. And in 1991, he recorded his first album in over 12 years. It featured Eric Clapton and Jeff Beck. His new album, Feels Like Rain, is on Silvertone Records. Before we meet Buddy Guy, there's a solo I want you to hear from his new album. This is a Muddy Waters song called She's 19 Years Old.
What says something to you? Now don't tell. You get mad. You're barbecuing the woman that I ever had. She's 19 years old, and she got ways just like a baby child. I'm just trying to make this little woman feel satisfied.
Buddy Guy, welcome to Fresh Air. You were messing around with guitar distortion before you'd heard rock guitarists like Hendrix do it. Can I ask you how you started discovering that on your own?
Accidentally. Actually, in Chicago there, we didn't have stages. We'd always go in a corner and play. And they had jukeboxes during the breaks, and they would play tunes. And that's how I learned, by listening to other people, greats, Muddy, Walter, Wolf, and so on. And I forgot to turn my guitar off one day, and a lady passed by, and her dress tail hit the G string, and it just stayed there with an extortion for about 20 minutes. And I said, I'll never forget that. And I went up, and it worked with me, and I've been doing it ever since.
Well, explain this again. Her dress touched the G string?
Yeah, and I forgot to cut it off, and it was lying against the amplifier, you know. And as I said, we didn't have a stage. We were just in the corner playing, and she'd get up from her table to probably go get a drink or use the bathroom or something like that. And I said, wow, I forgot to cut my guitar off. It was right in tune with the particular tune that was playing on the jukebox.
So then how did you start using that yourself intentionally?
Well, after I found out it would stay and extort that long, I just went up one day and played and stood right there where it was, and it worked.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you were recording for Chess Records back in the first part of the 60s, you were already doing some of this on stage, I think, but you've said that Leonard Chess didn't like that. He wouldn't let you cut loose.
Well, first of all, you know, Leonard had gotten to the point that, you know, let's, for an example, if you had went in there and say, I want to do some rapping now, they would have shot you with a shotgun, you know. But if you was in the streets, you know what the young people was asking for and what was they was reacting to the, what you was playing. And I was like throwing the guitar down, missing notes, and it was ringing out with distortion and stuff, and people was going crazy saying, look at that, listen to that. And I would try to take it back and say, this is what's out there. And they would say, get out of here, you know. And I'm like saying, okay. And later on in his life, I think it was like 3, 4, 6 months before he passed away, he called me in and said, I want to talk to you. And he had found out because that was a Hendrix, a Eric and the Cream and so on playing that. He looked at me and said, how dumb could I be? You've been trying to give me this stuff for so long. And I was calling it noise, not selling in the millions. I said, you kidding me? You know, and it was just like a joke to me.
Well, Buddy Guy, I want to play one of your first records with Chess recordings, and all your stuff with Chess has recently been reissued. And you were saying that Leonard Chess wouldn't let you do what you really wanted to, but this is a really pretty good recording. It's called First Time I Met the Blues. It was recorded in 1960. Little Brother Montgomery's at the piano. Do you remember this session?
Yes, that's Little Brother Montgomery tune. Him and Willie Dixon got me together on that because I was with Cobra Records before that, and I got with Chess in the 60s, and that's the tune they brought me first. And I was more of a student, a listener, well, whatever you might say at that time, and I was doing whatever they thought was best for me in order for me to get a record out with the Chess people, because otherwise if I'd went in there and said, look, I'm doing it my way, I would have been, you probably wouldn't be talking to me now, because that was the company then at the time to try to get recorded with.
Okay, well, let's hear it. Recorded in 1960, my guest Buddy Guy on guitar and vocals.
The first time I met the blues, even though I was walking down through the woods. Yeah!
Buddy Guy, and that session's just been reissued on the Complete Chess Studio Recordings. Let me mention, too, you have a new album, which we'll be hearing from a little bit later again, and that's called Feels Like Rain. Let's go back to your very early years. Your father was a sharecropper. Did your parents want you to get off the plantation? Were you brought up with the sense of when you get old enough, you should really get out of here?
My parent was like, I got two sisters and two brothers, five of us. And they was like sharecroppers, and they would teach us all that when we got grown, if you go away, I want you to go away. Do better than we did. And if you marry an elephant, if you love him, we have to like him. And that's just the way they was until they passed away. They never was the type of people that try to choose what we should do or what not. They just told me, son, don't be the best in town. Just be the best until the best come around.
Were there any musicians on the plantation where you grew up?
Not really. It was a distant guy. My dad brought the first guitar for me from, and his mother, my grandmother. And if she was living, I was talking to you today, and you 10 minutes conversation with her, she would figure out that we was related in some kind of way or another. But sooner or later, if you think back real deep religious-wise, I guess we are in a way of speaking. But she could figure that out, and this guy was supposed to be some kind of distant relative of ours. And that's just the way they had me feeling. And I kind of feel that way now with the music I'm playing and going and traveling around the world. Everybody I see looks and smiles the same, you know. I just see you bigger, taller, smaller, different colors, but we still walking around on two legs, drinking water and eating food and sleeping and talking.
So she got this guy to give you a guitar or
no,
teach
my
you guitar?
No, my dad played $2.2 for it, and it had two strings on it. No, first electric guitar I saw was Lightning Slim, and I gave him my weekly allowances, which is 35 cents.
Oh, you heard him playing and you...
No, he came through on a Sunday evening, plugged up on the storefront porch and played Booker Chiller.
Mm-hmm. So how did you get your first amplifier?
A stranger bought my first real guitar and my first real amplifier. He bought it for me. Actually, I was sitting on my sister's porch with the two strings trying to get my first year in high school. My mother had a stroke, and a stranger passed and said, son, I bet if you had a guitar, you would learn how to play. And this is a Thursday evening. I said, probably so. And he said, what are you doing tomorrow? I said, I sit here every evening. And the next evening, he came by and said, let's go. And I said, why? He said, I'm going by your guitar. And he took me downtown and bought the guitar. My sister came in, and we were laughing. It was drinking the quarter beer. And I said, well, let's go in the country where my mom and dad at. And the country boy with a country guitar. And the guy followed us out. Then, strangely enough, him and my dad talked for 10 minutes, and they grew up together as boys.
So who was he?
The guy's name was Mitchell. He grew up as a boy with my dad. And after he bought the guitar, my dad tried to trace him down, which he moved to Chicago and became a preacher. And we never could track him down because I still owed him the money for the guitar. Still do.
So do you feel like you still owe him a lot of thanks? Do you feel like you were able to express?
A lot. And I'm sure wherever he is at this point, if there's any way that he should know I want to thank him. And I owe my whole career to him.
You left the plantation when you were 21. You went to Chicago.
No. I left the plantation trying to get to one-year high school and went into Baton Rouge.
Oh, I see.
And then I left Baton Rouge September 25th, 1957, 8:40 a.m. in the morning.
Wow, you really remember exactly the moment.
I can't forget that.
Tell me about that moment.
My mother was sick, and she had a stroke, and she kept telling me, if you don't live my life around her, because we were very close, and I figured that, you know, I should stay. And she said no, and she learned how to make us understand some of the things she was saying because it affects your speech. And she said go, you know, and I said, okay, if you happy, I'm gone. And she smiled and said go. And when she heard the first record I made, to tell me, she gave him a big smile.
Did you see her again after you left?
Oh yeah, I went to see her every year until she passed away. She passed away April 16, 1968. I had been jamming with Hendrix when she passed away.
Huh.
Oh yeah.
So you went to Chicago. Why did you choose Chicago?
I didn't go to Chicago to be a musician. I went there looking for better common labor employment, and I got there and got stranded and wound up being forced to play guitar. Because at one point in my life, I was too shy to even talk. You wouldn't get the answers you get now from me when I was about 20 years old. I can tell you that.
So were you playing on the street for money?
No. This stranger met me on the street and led me, and I played a Jim Reed song for him, and he led me to this famous club. It was the 708 Club, and that's the address, 708 East 47th Street, and that was Otis Rush on stage. And he let me, went on stage, and I played a song, and somebody went and called Muddy. And he come out, and I was telling him I was trying to get back to Louisiana because I was busted, hungry, and had an aid on going on the third day. And he come and brought the salami and the loaf of bread and say, don't think about going back to Louisiana.
Muddy Waters said that?
Yeah.
So what happened next? Then you started getting bookings?
No, they start coming. Yeah, well, the local clubs. It wasn't no such thing as booking and traveling, but I got to work in that club and a few more. I had a million clubs in Chicago that time and 2 million musicians. And you had to play the top 10 on the jukebox, at least some of them, to get in the clubs. And fortunately, I could do that. I had to play the Ray Charles, What I Say. I had to play B.B. King. I had to play Muddy Waters. I had to play Bobby Bland. And I had the advantage of some of the guys, because some of them would just want to be Muddy Waters or Howlin' Wolf or Little Walter. And I didn't stay at that. I tried to learn them all, Lightning Hopkins and everybody. And so I had a little advantage to that because I learned how to copy all of their music.
Tell me more about what the blues scene was like in Chicago when you started playing there.
For 6.5 or 7 years, I didn't know what was the weekend. I had to go back and ask somebody when was Sunday, because we even had jam sessions start at 7 o'clock on Monday morning, and you couldn't get in the place.
Were there, like, blues cutting contests?
Yes, that's what it was all about. It was so many clubs still. After someone decided to hire me in a club, Junior, Otis, Freddie King, Magic Sam, and Earl Hooker, just to name a few of us, We all had gigs each night. Each club was packed. A lot of people was working at a big stockyard, the steel mill, and the shift was 7, 8 o'clock in the morning. That's why the Blue Monday could work. And in order for us to get together and play, we had to all say, let's start playing at 7 o'clock on Monday morning. Then don't nobody have a gig at night. And that's how we got to really jam together with Muddy, Wolf, Otis, myself, Junior, and everybody else. And that's why so many people would be there in the morning, because they said, man, you go to this club with a Blue Monday, you see Muddy, you see Sonny Boy, you see Little Walter, man, what a jam.
If you're just joining us, my guest is blues guitarist and singer Buddy Guy. He's got a new album called Feels Like Rain. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. The great blues guitarist and singer Buddy Guy is with us. He has a new CD called Feels Like Rain. I saw you in Buffalo at the State University there. I guess it was the late 1960s. And the way I remember it, you started off on stage, but midway through the concert, you were like down the aisles, out the door, through the other end of the student union, and I think you maybe led us all outside and then back in again. I don't remember if I've exaggerated or not over the years, but you led us pretty far on
Well, that's the same thing was happening in Chicago. I had sense enough to know I couldn't challenge Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, or some of those great giants who I was learning from. And I was just trying to get some attention to let someone know that I had something that they were always sitting in chairs. Matter of fact, the blues, B.B. King does it now. He was doing it the other night. He said, we're not tired. We're just sitting down to let you know how blues was played 42 years ago. And I was like, I saw Guitar Slam, which I mentioned earlier, and I said, well, look, they can outplay me, but they can't outdo me. So I just started jumping up, laying out on my back with the guitar under my back. And, you know, you got to do this like an exercise. You know, you raise your back up off it and just pick the strings. If you can find a way to put your fingers in the right place, you can play it anywhere.
Did you have to get really, really, really long guitar wires from your guitar to the amplifier in order to walk as far as you did?
Well, actually, I saw Guitar Slam with that. First of all, when I first got to Chicago, I would go to the shop to have this wire made. They wouldn't make it because they'd tell me it wasn't going to work. I said, well, give me the wire. I'll make it. And I had learned how to solder my own ends on there. And finally, one of the technicians came out and said, this guy's crazy. I don't believe this thing is coming through. And they used to examine my wife. One guitar player cut it in half one night because he figured I had somebody else behind the curtain playing.
You know, it's funny. You've gone from being, a younger person trying to establish himself and trying to figure out who he is and what makes him different from everybody else, to being now, you know, one of the blues legends that everybody wants to emulate. You've talked a lot about how you felt like you really had to like work hard and outdo everybody else, you know, to call attention to who you were. Do you still, does that still motivate the kind of show that you do? I mean, because now you're a Buddy Guy. I mean, everybody knows who you are.
Not quite everybody. You know, I'm not as well known as some people who play the guitar out there. I wish I were, you know, then maybe I wouldn't have to work so hard, but And in another sense, maybe I don't want to be like that. It might stop me from working as hard as I do. Because if you come and see me, I want you to have 110-120% of Buddy Guy, nothing less. Because if I get to the point I start taking that from you, I don't think I want to play anymore.
Do you still have the energy to do the kind of show you used to do?
I don't know if I have as much as I had. I'm not going to lie to you and tell you I feel like I was when I was 17 years old. But when I pick up my guitar, I feel like I'm 14.
Your 1991 album, Damn Right I've Got the Blues, was your first album, and I think it was 12 years?
12 and a half.
Why didn't you record for that period?
I wish I could ask you that. The record company didn't think I had anything to offer, I don't suppose, because the tragic night of Stevie Ray Vaughan's death, I was there as a guest with him and Eric, and they said, something wrong, you know, we got to take you to the studio, we have to take you ourselves, and we're going to be there to record with you. And Eric was there. Unfortunately, Stevie passed away, and he wasn't there, but he was going to be there on the session, too, and I think that helped a lot. Eric did a lot. he brought me into London for 2 years in a row at the Royal Albert Hall. I got a lot of publicity out there, and I think some record company said, well, we better check him out. Everybody's talking about how good he is. So I said, well, I better do my best on this. Damn right, I got the blues. So they came in, and that's my first gold record.
So the people who you had influenced over the years, the rock guitarists who you'd influenced over the years, helped you when you needed the help.
And they still do. You know, actually, and I'm trying to do the same thing now. It's just one of these things now. Record companies is not as, how should I say that, as bad as they was years ago. But this my artist, you can't go there. We're playing more together now. I got a chance to do a cut with B.B. King. I did Coco Tell. I just did Junior Wells coming out. I made a range of Otis Fresh, got a new record coming out, and so on. Which, you know, on mine, there's Bonnie Raitt, there's Paul Rodgers, there's Travis Tritt, and we just like saying, hey, man, let's get together and have some fun. And mm-hmm. when they invite me over, hey, it's never too late. It's never too early. Just call me, and I'll be there.
Let me ask you about the influence of B.B. King on your playing and what the influence has been and where the point of departure is. You've known him a long time. You've been on stage with him a bunch of times.
Well, let me put it to you like this. His influence should be on every guitar player that picks up a guitar, because he told me when I first met him, he didn't learn how to use the slide, and we all, Eric, Stevie, myself, Albert King, Albert Collins, we all squeeze the strings. And I tell him every time I get a chance to talk with him, he's the one that invented that, squeezing the string and bending it the way we do. I'm still learning from him. And as long as he's around, I still think his name should be on every guitar that's put out there.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes.
Buddy Guy, I have one last question for you. We're recording this interview.
Okay.
And we started recording this interview at 9:30 in the morning. And there are very, very few musicians who will wake up to do a 9:30 in the morning interview. You're on the road. You're in the middle of a tour. How the heck did you get up this early?
Well. Honestly, I'm still a country farm boy, and I don't want to change that. And all of my life, I don't care how late I stay up or what, I still get the sleep that I think I need. But it's just the thrill of my life. I love this as well as I do my guitar. To get up at 5:30, maybe even at 5 in the morning, and go out and take a big, deep breath of fresh air and say, I remember when I had to get up like this and go feed the hogs, chickens, and cows, and I still get the fresh air. And I got two little dogs whenever I'm at home, and I don't need an alarm clock.
Buddy Guy, thank you so much. It's really been such a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, thank you very much, and I enjoyed every minute of it. Don't wait so long next time.
Buddy Guy, recorded in August. Here's more from his latest album, Feels Like Rain. This is James Brown's I Go Crazy. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Annie Ross helped create the singing style called vocalese. And as part of the trio, Lambert Hendricks and Ross, she helped popularize it. Coming up, an interview from the archives with Annie Ross about her singing career, her days as a child actress, and her return to the screen. She's currently featured in the new Robert Altman film, Shortcuts. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews tonight's season premiere of Picket Fences. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Haiti, U.S. officials have warned military leaders against seizing fuel supplies after pumps were shut off in order to comply with a U.N. embargo. The prime minister also said that he had told Haiti's armed forces not to interfere with fuel distributors. However, the interim government has no control over the military and police. One aid group based in Florida said its first supplies of food and medicine have been blocked by ships enforcing a U.N. arms and oil embargo. Some service stations in the capital are open, with soldiers standing guard. After 2 weeks of debating the role of U.S. military forces overseas, the Senate will undertake a review of the proper use of American troops in the post-Cold War period. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
In recent days, the Senate has debated when to pull U.S. troops from Somalia and whether to send them to Haiti and Bosnia, illustrating a long-standing conflict between the legislative and executive branches. The 1973 War Powers Act requires American forces be withdrawn from hostile situations unless Congress gives its approval, but no president has recognized the act. Armed Services Committee Chairman Sam Nunn says it's time to scrap it.
That act has to be revisited. My general thinking is we need to move much more to a consultative mechanism so that the president consults with the Congress before making these decisions and not after that.
Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell wants a bipartisan Senate review of U.S. policy toward post-Cold War conflicts to be finished by next spring. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
In the Middle East, Israel has announced it is easing restrictions on Palestinians who want to enter Israel. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Last March, Israel imposed a closure on the West Bank and Gaza Strip after a spate of Palestinian attacks on Israelis. Since then, Palestinians have only been allowed to enter Israel with a special permit, given mostly to workers. Today, the police minister announced a sweeping easing of these restrictions. Beginning next week, all women and men over 40 will not need permits. Children under 16 accompanied by adults with permits will also be allowed in, as will Palestinian doctors and teachers. The move is part of a series of Israeli goodwill gestures since the signing of the Israel-PLO agreement last month. Israel has also agreed to gradually release thousands of Palestinian prisoners beginning next week. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
President Clinton will travel to Moscow in mid-January for a summit meeting with Russian President Boris Yeltsin. Vice President Gore will be in Moscow in December. Secretary of State Warren Christopher is in Moscow now, where he met today with Yeltsin for nearly 1 hour. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 13 points to close at 3,649.30 on volume of 301 million shares. This is NPR News. Once again, air traffic in and out of France has been disrupted. This morning, there were clashes between riot police and some 3,000 Air France employees trying to march onto runways at the Paris airports. Strikers have voted to continue their demonstrations in protest of some 4,000 job cuts along with pay cuts. France's transportation minister has called on the air carrier to open talks on charges that ground workers are being treated more harshly than cabin staff and pilots. The company has said the cutbacks are vital in order to keep the airline going. 9 Midwestern states damaged by flooding this summer are receiving a total of some $65 million for health and social services. NPR's Cheryl Duvall reports.
At the height of the flood crisis, counselors at emergency relief centers predicted that the people they were seeing this summer might suffer from substance abuse, family violence, and other stress-related problems for months after their homes and businesses were damaged. The relief money announced today by the Federal Department of Health and Human Services is intended to address those social and mental health needs, as well as to help states with flood-related public health concerns, including water quality and mosquito control. Congress appropriated the funding as part of the Clinton administration's flood relief package. Health and Human Services determined the size of the grants, ranging from more than $22 million for Iowa to $1 million for North Dakota, after state agencies had reported their needs to the department. In Chicago, I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.
In Bosnia, a planned exchange of prisoners has been postponed for at least 10 days, apparently because of a lack of security guarantees. Red Cross officials say a major problem is a lack of information on hundreds of missing people, most of them Muslims. There are some 5,500 prisoners to be turned over to Croatian and Muslim officials. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Robert Altman's new film, Shortcuts, features Annie Ross, the same Annie Ross that sang with Lambert Hendricks and Ross. So we've brought out a 1990 interview with her from our archives. Dave Lambert, John Hendricks, and Annie Ross were perhaps the most popular jazz vocal group of the late 50s and early 60s. They did vocalese, that is, their songs put words to jazz instrumental arrangements and improvisations. Annie Ross left the trio in 1962, moved to England, and ran her own club for a couple of years. Since then, she's appeared in many British stage and TV productions and has appeared in several American films. The song Ross is best known for is Twisted. She wrote her lyric to a melody and improvisation by tenor saxophonist Wardell Gray. Twisted has been recorded by Bette Midler and Joni Mitchell. This is Lambert Hendricks and Ross.
My analyst told me
what?
That I was right out of my head the way he described it.
How?
He said I'd be better dead than alive. I didn't listen to his jive. I knew all along he was all wrong, and I knew that he thought
what?
I was crazy, but I'm not. Oh, no.
Oh, no.
My analyst told me
what?
That I was right out of my head. He said I need treatment,
yeah.
But I'm not that easily led. He said I was the type that was most inclined, went out of his sight, to be out of my mind. And he thought I was nuts,
nuts.
No more ifs, or ands, or buts. Oh no.
Oh no.
Oh no.
They say as a child I appeared a little bit wild with all my crazy ideas, but I knew what was happening. I knew I was a genius. What's so strange when you know that you're a wizard of three? I knew that this was meant to be. But I heard little children were supposed to sleep tight. That's why I drank a bit of the vodka one night. My parents got frantic, didn't know what to do. But I saw some crazy scenes before I came to. Now, do you think I was crazy? I may have been only three, but I was swinging. They all have been angry and bad. They all have been innocent and also an Einstein. So why should I feel sorry if they just couldn't understand the reasoning and the logic that went on in my head? I had a brain, it was a pain though, to let them love me when I refused to ride on all the double-decker buses, all because there was no driver on the top.
No driver on the top.
She must be out of her head.
What's the matter with her?
My analyst told me
what?
That I was right out of my head the way he described it.
Annie Ross, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
We just heard Twisted.
Yeah.
I just need to ask you if you were in analysis when you wrote that.
No, I was not and have never been. It was really suggested, the title Twisted suggested to me the whole story of a woman going to an analyst. But no, I wasn't in analysis.
How did you start doing vocalese, putting words to jazz solos?
Well, I went to see a man called Bob Weinstock, who had a record label, and we talked, and he said, you know, have you heard Moody's Mood for Love? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, do you think you could do something like that? And I said, sure. You know, necessity is the mother of invention, and my necessity was need of money. So I took a stack of records home, played them. The one that I really liked was Twisted. And I was back the next morning with the lyrics.
And then you started doing more of it because it caught on so well?
Yes, and I love the idea. It was really a challenge. It was so different from writing a you know, regular song. And I enjoyed telling a story, having a beginning and a middle and an end, you know.
Did you want to keep singing standards even when you were doing vocalese?
Oh, sure. I mean, I don't think quality diminishes, and you can't beat great songs. I mean, there are some wonderful, wonderful ballads. They don't go out of style. They, you know, come around again after a long time. I got very bored because I had always sung standards, and, you know, I thought, I don't want to sing this anymore or that anymore. But then years pass, and you look at them with a fresh eye, and like I say, the quality is still there, and they're masterpieces.
We're listening to a 1990 interview with singer Annie Ross. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Annie Ross is my guest.
Let me play a song that you recorded before you teamed up with Lambert and Hendrix. This is from a 1957 session that you made with baritone saxophonist Jerry Mulligan.
Mm-hmm.
And the session has recently been reissued. The title is Annie Ross Sings a Song with Mulligan. And I'm going to play the Dietzen Schwartz song. I guess I'll have to change my plans.
Oh, good.
Well, I guess I'll have to change my plans. I should have realized I'd lose my favorite man. I overlooked that point completely until the big affair began. Before I knew where I was at, I found myself upon a shelf, and that was that. I tried to reach the moon, but when I got there, all that I could get was the air. My feet are back upon the ground, 'cause I've lost the one man that I found.
My guest Annie Ross recorded with Jerry Mulligan. So how did you team up with John Hendrix and Dave Lambert?
I happened to be at a friend's house, Bob Bach, and he and his wife Jean Bach were very dear friends of mine. Jean, of course, still is. And they got a phone call from Dave, I think it was. Yeah, that's right, because he knew Bob. And he said, I have this idea about putting words to a Count Basie album. Can I come over, bring John, and demonstrate what we have? I said, sure. So he said, do you want to stick around, Annie, and see what's happening? I said, sure. So round they came. They played one of Basie's numbers. They both sang the solos. I thought, hey, that's great. And the next thing I knew, they asked me if I would come down and conduct some session singers that they had engaged to record about, I think, 4 or 6 tracks. And they said, you know, that the women, they wanted me to give the women the bassy feel. Well, that was a laugh in itself. I mean, you can't teach that to anybody. You have to be born with it, be brought up with it. And I tried, but like I said, you can't just teach that, and especially not in, you know, half an hour or whatever. The upshot was that the session time had, a couple of hours to go on the record session. They had no more that they could do because what they had was not good. They were going to scrap it. And the producer was tearing his hair out and saying, my God, we've lost this money and blah, blah, blah. And Dave Lambert, who was into electronic things, etc., said, well, what about if we multi-track? Well, I said, of course. I didn't know what multi-tracking was, but I figured I'd better not show my ignorance. Anyway, he then explained what it was. So he said, what we have to do, Annie, we'll get rid of the singers. You, John, and I'll go into a room. We'll rehearse. We'll learn all the harmonies so that we multi-track four times. So I said, okay. And, I mean, you know, we all had great ears. We heard the chord sequences. Learning the solos was not that difficult for us. And it was, I think, one of the great moments of my life because we heard the first track back. And that was fine. That was the melody. Then we recorded the second track. They played it with the first track. Well, well, that was something else. Then the third track was unbelievable. The fourth track was mind-blowing. And we knew we had something absolutely great. It was that feeling that we were breaking new ground, that we were creating. And it was exciting, and I felt giddy. I mean, it was just a wonderful, wonderful moment.
So the group stuck together, but most of your stuff was not over track like that. It was mostly just straightforward trio. You left Lambert, Hendricks, and Ross in 1962. This was before the group broke up, and you were actually replaced by another singer, Yolanda Bavon. Why did you leave?
Well, there are many reasons, primarily because I was fed up with going on the road. I really didn't feel that I had any kind of a life. And I wasn't brought up with my family. I felt that I really needed to try to find my roots and kind of find out who I was. And I always loved Europe. I'd spent many years there in Paris. And so I decided I would stay. And I eventually met Sean Lynch, who was an actor who I married. And I said, a tout à l'heure to the United States for a little while.
Well, once you got to England, for a couple of years, you had your own club called Annie's Place.
Annie's Room.
Annie's Room, thank you. And then after that, I think you started doing stage work and even some television.
I did a lot of television at the same time as having the club. But the club was also very difficult. It bore my name, and the people who went there wanted to see me, which meant I had to be there every night. And it was like every night was a party, you know. I wouldn't go there till, say, 11 o'clock at night. I'd get home about 5. I would sleep until 1 or 2. I mean, it was a crazy, wonderful, but mixed up kind of time in my life.
Annie Ross is my guest. You came to America from England when you were, I think, 6 years old.
Scotland. 5 and a half.
Okay.
No, 4 and a half. I was 4 and a half when I arrived.
Now, once you got to America, didn't you stay there with your aunt, the singer Ella Logan?
Yes, I did. I came to New York with my mother and father and my elder brother, and I won a contest, a radio contest. The prize was a 6-month, really a token contract with MGM. And I went out to L.A. with my aunt because my aunt started doing films. And then my mother left. My father and mother and brother all went back. And I was raised in Beverly Hills in L.A.
Did your parents have any reservations about leaving you?
I'm sure they did. Sure.
Did they want it that way, or was it you who
I think they probably felt that it was best for me to do that, that maybe through doing that I could become a star. But they already had stars.
You mean California already had stars?
Sure, they had Shirley Temple and Jane Withers and, you know, many, many young kids.
Well, how were you groomed? What kind of image were you given?
The Shirley Temple image, but with a kilt.
Oh, because you were Scottish.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
I had a thick Scottish accent, too.
Well, that must have been rough.
Oh, I think everybody thought it was adorable.
Did you have those little curls?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
So you had won this mini contract at MGM through the talent show?
Yes.
And when the contract was up, what happened?
That was it. I was up. they had no use for me, and my aunt, who was really my guardian, decided that I needed an education and that she didn't want me to get big-headed and, you know, all those things.
So what happened next?
Well, then I just went to school. And then when I was 16, I came to New York and I went into the Academy of Dramatic Art, the American Academy of Dramatic Art, and stayed there for a year, then went back to Scotland and re-met my family.
What was it like to meet them after not having seen them for so long?
Well, as you can imagine, it was weird. It was very strange. I didn't know them at all. And this is your brother, and this is your brother, and this is your brother, and this is your sister, and this is your aunt, and this is your grandma. Please, you know, I hadn't seen them since I was four.
How did you start listening to and then performing jazz?
Well, my aunt gave me a record of Ella Fitzgerald singing A Tisket a Tasket when I was four. And I learned it, and I could do it. And a wonderful thing about my aunt was that in our house in L.A., there were always a lot of musicians who hung around. And they were musicians from Duke Ellington's band, indeed, Duke Ellington himself, Roy Eldridge, Earl Garner. And so I moved toward modern jazz as opposed to Dixieland.
Do you expect to be singing more? How much do you sing nowadays?
At the moment, I don't sing very much at all, but I am getting... I can feel that kind of restless feeling that says, yeah, you should... You know, I mean, I go and see singers a lot. And from them, I get an idea of, oh, now wait a minute. I remember a song that I really loved that I'd like to do. And I'm getting that kind of thirst for it again.
Annie Ross recorded in 1990. She's featured in the new Robert Altman film, Shortcuts. This is one of the songs she sings on the Shortcuts CD.
I'm gonna like somebody and let them like me. Going further means change. I was born to be free. To hell with love. To hell with love. I'll find a way to keep from getting in too deep. To hell with love.
This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's joining us from Washington, D.C. Linda, I understand your mayor is trying to call out the National Guard.
Yes, the mayor is asking the president, Terry, to give her some help with the National Guard to fight crime in the District of Columbia. We'll talk about the district and its problems and, in general, about the use of troops to control crime. Patty Naiman has a really interesting piece about health and personal responsibility. If you smoke, drink, ski, do dangerous things, should you have to pay more for health insurance? We'll look at Tailhook, at the Super Collider, Somalia and Haiti. We have reporters in both places. And we will remember Fridays with Red Barber.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Last month at the Emmy Awards, the CBS show Picket Fences surprised almost everyone by winning Best Dramatic Series, Best Actor, Tom Skerritt, and Best Actress, Kathy Baker. Tonight, during a break in the World Series action, Picket Fences begins its second season. TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
Even though Picket Fences was the best new drama on TV last season, CBS almost didn't renew it. Ratings were low, and preempting or moving the show every few weeks sure didn't help. But the unexpected Emmy sweep against such quality competitors as I'll Fly Away and Northern Exposure gave Picket Fences a big shot in the arm. Now, to open its second season, Picket Fences starts off with a big shot in the head. The town's mayor, played by Michael Keenan, is attacked by a carjacker right outside City Hall. But the mayor has a gun in his briefcase and forces the bad guy to drop his weapon. So far, so good. But the unarmed carjacker standing 5 feet away pays no attention to the mayor's next command.
Lie down on the ground. You take the car, I walk away. I said lie down! You got me an attempted robbery, tops. I'm looking at 6 to 8. Chop to 3 if I'm good.
Shut your mouth.
No, see, I think you want to hear this. See, if I do time, I gotta come looking for the guy responsible. That's who I am. That's right. You take a good long look at me. Don't I seem like the kind of psycho who might come back? I bet you got kids, too.
That's how writer-producer David E. Kelley sets up the second season opener, with a sort of shocker that hasn't been seen on TV since the good old days of St. Elsewhere. After all, the mayor was around all last season. But once he's killed one of his own citizens, he can't get away with murder. Or can he? If you watched Picket Fences a lot, you'll love seeing how the townspeople of Rome, Wisconsin react to the killing. But if you're new to the show, Picket Fences has built in the perfect way to get you indoctrinated quickly. The show brings in a new character, District Attorney Jonathan Littleton. He's played by Don Cheadle, and we get to watch as he meets the people of Rome one by one. As in this scene, when Defense Attorney Wombau, played by Five-ish Finkel, barges in on a meeting between the sheriff and the DA and starts right in on the new guy in town.
Off the record, let me provide you with a little free discovery. That is my gift to you as a welcome present.
I'm not looking for any gifts.
Take one anyway. What you're both thinking about is stupid. Do you know what kind of a witness Carter Pike is? A rumor necrophiliac who chases tornadoes? And Howard Buss? I can get continuances, drag this out, and by the time we get to trial, his Alzheimer's would have damaged his brain. He wouldn't be able to talk, much less have a memory.
Who is this man?
I'm Douglas Wombau, and I win my cases.
The DA plays the same role in Picket Fences that Dr. Fleischman played at the start of Northern Exposure, a stranger in a strange land thrown by the eccentricities of the locals. But the bonus for those of us who watched Picket Fences last year is that we already know the people of this town. As a result, we can enjoy his reactions to them, and vice versa, all the more. But the most enjoyable thing about Picket Fences is its complexity. Whatever your opinion on this particular murder case, Picket Fences will challenge it, shake it up, maybe even change it. You may be surprised, you may be saddened, but you won't be bored.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker and Audrey Voblitis. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Devin Reif and Abby Fanta are our interns. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Bob Edwards has written a new book about the late Red Barber and the weekly conversations they had about sports on Morning Edition. On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk with Bob Edwards about his Fridays with Red and about Bob's own career on the radio. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.